father tell me how it was when you were young? Was the world so very old when your life had just begun? Oh, grandfather, tell me, is it true you worked the land? And the tools that you used, you made with your own hands. Before time was only money and machines made man a slave. Was the world all milk and honey before all the streets were paved?
Good afternoon. This is Katie and Kay, and you're listening to Living Permaculture, Katie and Kay's source for information on how to live a more sustainable life. I'm Kathleen. I'm engineering the show. On the call is Jerome Ostentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, and our guest today is Greg Peterson. What if there was a garden and fruit tree in every yard? This is a question that Greg ponders every day. For over 30 years, he's been working on one of Phoenix's first environmental showcase homes for urban farming. This one-third acre yard features a primarily edible landscape with over 50 fruit trees, rainwater and graywater harvesting, solar applications, and extensive use of reclaimed and recycled building materials. Greg is also the host of the Urban Farm podcast that in just 5.5 years has released over 600 episodes, amassing over 2.5 million listens to date. On his days off, he hangs out in his garden with Heidi, his sweetheart, Kismet, their pooch, creating new projects and catching some rays. Did I say your dog's name right, Greg?
Absolutely. Kismet, it is.
Perfect. All right, so let's dive in here. I want to hear your take, Greg, on the definition of permaculture.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Permaculture for me has been a lifelong thing, but I didn't know about permaculture until halfway through my life. And I started studying permaculture in 1991 when a flyer arrived in the mailbox. I have no idea where the flyer came from, but it was a flyer for a permaculture design course in Phoenix. I remember bringing it in the house and telling my partner, Michelle, oh my gosh, we need to go do this. And that's when I dove in. And what I discovered that in that 72 hours that I did a permaculture design course was that for me, permaculture is the art and science of working with nature. How do we plug in and work with nature? We human beings, we think we know how to do it better than nature, and nature always laughs at us. So for me, permaculture is watching nature and then working in the flow of nature rather than against nature, as we human beings like to do.
I have another really shorter version of it. You know, every state has a billboard. And if you drive into the Maine, the billboard says the way it ought to be.
Right?
Yeah. That's the way I look at it. And also just the fact that, you know, you look at natural systems, and then we design our systems that, you know, work alongside or include all the wildlife, include all the natural, you know, predators. And otherwise, you know, you're just fighting against the world, you know.
It sounds like that flyer you got was under some, you know, well-aligned stars that you happened
right?
to receive a copy of that flyer.
Well, and, again, that was 30 years ago, so.
So that was some literature that, let's say, that shifted, you know, your perspective. So tell me about a book that also influenced your work.
Yeah, so for me, 1991, I was 30 in 1991, was a pivotal year. There were four major things that happened for me. I already mentioned one of them. I did my first permaculture design course. And the second thing that happened was I did a course with Landmark Education that I had to create my vision for my life. And what I created for myself at the age of 30 was I'm the person on the planet responsible for transforming our global food systems. Because when I pivot back and look back to when I was 15 years old, I had written a paper in grade school on how we were overfishing the oceans. I have no idea where that came from.
Wow.
I have a long-term relationship with looking at how things are in the world. The third thing that happened for me, and this was a key piece of my life, a friend of mine went sailing in the South Pacific And they anchored in an island looking for a grocery store. And the people that were living on the island kind of looked at them funny and said, go pick your own. I was like, oh, you mean food is free? And that all correlates back to Ishmael, a book by Daniel Quinn. It's a conversation between a gorilla and a man that I discovered in 1991. I discovered this book. And it's a conversation on how we have come as human beings over the past 10,000 years to dominate the planet. And in Ishmael, Quinn really reviews how we got here and points at different things that we can do. And one of the very interesting things for me in that book is that it points a lot to permaculture. And one of my basic premises of permaculture is observation. Go out and watch. Go out and look. Go out and pay attention to what's going on in your space, and then make changes to your systems that you have in your space and make them slowly to make sure that you are, that we are working with nature.
Yeah.
That's great. You know, I have a mountain that I go up and get my, it's my mentor, Basalt Mountain, and unfortunately, a lot of that burned a few years ago. So I don't have, you know, the mentor I had. But you know, that for 45 years, I've been hiking up on Basalt Mountain and looking at how that whole ecosystem evolved. It's an extinct volcanic mountain, and it's basically a rock pile with a thin veneer of vegetation. And, you know, the gills are all there, you know, you're playing out. And it's a fascinating classroom. You know, I come down and we are actually under our 35th year of doing the permaculture design class this year. So
wow,
we've been doing this class probably the longest in the world. Probably had a wake-up call about the same time you did. I think I was 30 when I started doing
nice
organic farming.
But
then we started doing permaculture, you know, about 10 years after that or so. But that's kind of my observations. And everyone should have, you know, some place to go and look at nature. We have plenty of wilderness. That will do. Any place you go, you'll find natural systems if you just, you know, sit down and look at them.
And I imagine there are some amount of similarity that we're both sort of based in the Southwest between Phoenix and Basalt, Colorado, although, you know, different areas for sure, but both in that sort of dry region. I imagine there's some similarities in how you all are operating your permaculture systems. But Greg, it seems like 1981 was a pivotal year for you. Can you tell us what happened then?
Yeah. So the 10 years, you know, I was born in 61. Not sure what happened in 71, but 81, there was a lot that happened. In 91, there was a lot that happened. And in 1981, I was in the Arizona Aquaculture Association. I was very fascinated as a young person on how people were doing fish farming on the planet. And so I jumped into the Arizona Aquaculture Association, and we traveled to different fish farms around the state looking to see what they were doing. And one of them, I was kind of a bit flabbergasted that they were harvesting the fish. Now, when you raise a fish and harvest it, you get about 30% meat and about 70% everything that's left over. And they were taking that 70% and they were throwing it away. A lot of it was going to the wildlife in the area, which that in itself is a huge problem. And so I started looking at their systems and started to design on paper. I still have this in a file. I designed on paper what would now be called a regenerative fish farm. And this was in 1981. And this was before I even knew what permaculture was. But I have these designs that I drew where everything in the system got used, where, you know, the fish parts were fertilizer and those fish parts went and fertilized other plants that then grew feed for the fish. And so it created these circular systems. And that's one of the big things that I've come to understand about permaculture and nature. And that is that permaculture and nature works in circular. There's circular systems. Human systems, and I've been looking at this for over 30 years, human systems are all linear. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. In permaculture, we call this degenerative design. And the problem with degenerative design is that they all end. So when you think about human systems, they're all designed with an end coming. That means that eventually they'll go away. When you look at natural systems, they're circular and they keep regenerating themselves. So human systems are degenerative. Natural systems are regenerative. So what we do in permaculture is we look to see how we can overlay natural systems or regenerative systems on human systems. And I don't really believe that we human beings can truly be regenerative. I think there's something missing in the way that we think that lets us be truly regenerative. So for me, working in my yard and working on permaculture designs, I designed them to be more regenerative. So that for me, this notion of permaculture, it's not necessarily a thing to do. Well, in permaculture, we do things, but it's a mindset. It's a way we think about how we're being on the planet and how we design. So permaculture, for me, is a design methodology of designing regenerative systems in our space. And in 1981, I started getting a clue. In 1991, I got a much bigger clue when I did my permaculture design course. And for me, it was, wow, there's actually something we can call the way that I think.
Cool. I love when those pieces sort of fall together like that.
Yeah, right?
The way we look at permaculture here at Crimpy is that we follow the carbon farming model. And Eric Tonesmeyer wrote a great book on carbon farming solutions. It's a textbook. Mm-hmm. He was an intern back in the 90s here, early 90s for 6 months. And he's gone on to write many books. And so we actually take carbon and turn it into topsoil. And there's many, many sources of carbon that are free. Most of it gets thrown away. You know, leaves get blown up, they get hauled to the dump, and they exit the backyard, the front yard. So all of the carbon is being exported to the dump, and then they sell it back to you after they contaminate it with sewer sludge. So we bring all those leaves here, we bring all the sawdust and all the wood chips for free. We have to haul it because we're on a mountainside. And then we turn that into worm castings and topsoil by using worms and shredders and the soil food web and also mycelium. But it's basically the same process that goes on in the rainforest, the temperate rainforest or the tropical rainforest for the most, mostly temperate rainforest. That's how soils get built over time. Trees fall down in the aspen forest. They get attacked by microbes and mycelium, and they eventually turn into, you know, and then things start sprouting around. The currents will come out of them, and, you know, that's what we do. And hookah culture is a big part of that as well. It's just not just using, leaves and grass clippings, but using wood. Incorporating that into your soil building is a long, kind of long, slow release. That mimics nature. And Seth Holster is the master of hookah culture. And he was doing permaculture way before permaculture. He even knew what permaculture was. And it's an ongoing thing. Right now I'm sitting in my patio above my Mediterranean greenhouse, and I have 5 beds that have been hookah cultured. And they're about ready to be planted. It was like a big sourdough loaf that steeped over the winter with worms and mycelium, with about 6 inches of leaves. And now it's ready to be planted. And I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to build compost. I didn't have to buy compost from some compost company and put it on my raised beds and grow an annual crop. I'm growing compost for free. I just have to, you know, do the fallow time. And it's fascinating. And we do that outside by just continually mulching. And we do worm farming in our pathways. And, oh, there's a bunch of videos out on our website about that. But that's my hit on these cycles that you were talking about.
Yeah. I like your comparison, Jerome, to a sourdough starter, I think you said.
Right.
It's a good visual. Yeah.
Hey, Kathleen, you had mentioned drylands. You know, we're in a mega drought at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I read another article this morning on it. So what we do here in the desert Southwest, and I suspect y'all are doing it in Colorado as well, Jerome, is we subscribe to drylands permaculture techniques. Is that the case for you, Jerome?
There was one time when we were talking about that we're in a 20-year drought in Colorado, and now they've kind of extended into a 100-year drought.
Yep.
And, you know, but unfortunately, you know, we do as many dryland strategies here as we can, and with, you know, swales. We have 2 acres of swales that we build, and we regenerated some pinyon and juniper. And it actually works as a wildlife corridor, a pollinator garden, a fire mitigation, a fire break, because it's above our house. But we have water. We have three sources of water. So I'm really cheating here because I do have a water right that I can use 24/7 during the summer. And I have ponds. I can store water. So I'm not affected by drought. And, you know, you can't really do agriculture in Colorado unless you have a water source. You really can't do dryland agriculture. Mm-hmm. So, again, we do have, we're at the top of the watershed, fortunately. And, you know, my water comes at 10,000 feet. You know, behind Basalt Mountain, there is a huge forest. Part of that burnt, but that's a volcanic mountain, so there's nothing but rock, volcanic rock. And when the snow and the rain comes down, it goes down to a sandstone lens, and then it runs laterally out into every ravine on the mountain. It's a free drinking fountain. And there are springs and creeks coming out of the mountain. And fortunately, with the fire, we actually have better water flows now than we did before, because there's not as much of being sucked up out by the forest. 12,000 acres of trees burnt. So that changed them. My springs are running better now than they were 2 years ago.
You said something very interesting. You're at the top of the watershed at 10,000 feet. That would put Arizona and Maricopa County at the bottom of the watershed at 1,250 feet, because a lot of our water comes from Colorado.
Wow.
I know. And so does Vegas. Las Vegas is at the bottom of the watershed, too.
Well, water is certainly a big issue across the West. I'd like to hear a little bit, Greg, about how you deal with, or at the urban farm, how you deal with lack of water. And then maybe we can get a little bit more into the urban farm itself.
Yay. So we're in the desert. And one of the big things that we do, and Jerome kind of touched on it with the Hugel culture conversation he had earlier, and that is building a lot of heavy mulch on top. One of the things that's happened over the past 5 years here in Phoenix is there's a gentleman named Jake Mace, and I have done a lot of pushing here in the desert Southwest to add 6 to 12 inches of woody mulch on all landscapes. And there are people out there that actually put 2 feet of woody mulch on their landscapes. And what that does is it adds organic matter to the dirt that's here. At the interface between the dirt and the woody mulch, it starts building really healthy soil. And then it acts like a sponge and it holds onto the water. So one of the big things that we do here in urban areas is build lots of organic matter in the soil to act like a sponge. Jerome mentioned swales earlier, and swales are great, but urban areas, they don't really apply. You can put swales in, and swales in permaculture, what we call an on-contour ditch that slows the water down and percolates it in. And in most urban landscapes, the land is flat, and so there's not a lot of water flow. So what the organic matter does is it acts as a way to soak up that water and percolate it in. So that's a big thing that we do here in the desert, is add lots and lots and lots of organic matter.
Well, that's the same thing that we do. And in our swales up on the wildlife corridor, we don't get enough rain here. We've never had the swales fill up, but they catch every drop of water. But it also catches all of the debris, every pine cone, every needle, every leaf, all goes in the bottom of the swale. And naturally, over time, it does similar things that you're just talking about, but very small, incremental. But I can go, and 1 year, there'll be 2 inches of organic matter that has accumulated in my swale. That's better than nothing. And all of that organic matter would have been down on the road, washing down to the Frying Pan River. But it, none of that leaves my 2 acres anymore. And so I can see that it's increasing the health of the pinyon and juniper. And we're also putting in deciduous trees. And we have a lot of ground covers now and a lot of grasses and native wildflowers and forage grasses for deer and the turkey. And so I have 40 turkeys that move through this corridor every day. And so I have all this manure. I'm providing some forage for them and a safe haven, but I in exchange get all this manure for free. It's like having free-range turkeys. The wildlife is kind of like the soul of the wilderness. If you don't have wildlife, and if you're not protecting them, and if you're not working with them, if you're not providing some ambiance and some protection for them, they're going to be a nuisance. But as long as you can work with them, they just walk around my 1 acre of edible landscaping that's fenced, and they never bother my commercial operation because they have their 2 acres, and it's magical. So that's what I like about, working with natural systems. And, you gain a little bit every year.
So, Greg, we've been hearing a little bit about how you got into permaculture. Now tell us about the urban farm and how it came to be.
Oh, my gosh. When I moved out of the house, I was 21 years old. I moved out of the house, and very soon after that, I started looking for a house to buy. And I was very interested in gardening for my entire life. So I started looking for a property that was appropriate for gardening in Phoenix. And so in 1989, I bought the place where I live now. It's a third of an acre. That's 80 feet wide and 160 feet deep. If you stand on my roof and looked 70 miles in each direction, you'd see city. So I'm literally right in the middle of Phoenix. And through the course of 1991, when I discovered permaculture, and 2001, when I had gone back to college and was studying plant biology and sociology and urban planning all mixed together, I had to write a paper. Again, a vision for my life. And what came out of that paper was my vision for the urban farm. And I like to call the urban farm an environmental showcase home. We do permaculture and regenerative design practices here that I open up periodically for people to come in and look. So we do tours, we do classes, and generally, it's become a place in Phoenix for people to go to understand how they can live more. And I hesitate using this word, but it's the word that's familiar for people, more sustainably.
That's probably one of the biggest differences between the operation here in Basalt and down in Phoenix, is Basalt is very quite rural. Not in the middle of a big city. But well, thank you so much, Greg, for your perspective and for chatting with us today on living permaculture. Mm-hmm. And thank you for listeners for sticking around. You can listen to this episode again or find past episodes at kdnk.org.
Son, remember in the days that are to come, one thing I will tell you before my life on earth is done. Don't let time be only money, don't let machines make you a slave, and taste the milk and honey before all the streets are paved. Yeah, there's more to time than money, more to treasure than to save. Taste the milk and honey before all the streets.